This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
So when one looks at Abraham Lincoln, be prepared for someone who is complicated, someone who is complex. He's not an easily predictable person. He's not a perfect person. He doesn't always get it right. As I like to say to people, Abraham Lincoln did not walk on the Potomac.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That's Dr. Alan Gelzo, Senior Research Scholar at the Council of the Humanities at Princeton University, also the author of multiple books, including Gettysburg, The Last Invasion, Abraham Lincoln, Redeemer President, and Robert E. Lee, A Life. The new book is Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment. We talk in depth with Dr. Gelzo about that book on today's program. Dr. Gelzo, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to talk with you again, Scott.
I am looking forward to a conversation about this new book on the great Abraham Lincoln. Let me begin by asking a general question. We'll talk in more detail, of course. But as we begin, tell our listeners why Abraham Lincoln had such confidence in democracy.
Well, for one thing, he believed in the democratic principle itself wholeheartedly. For him, that was, and the phrase he used, a political religion. And even the title of the book has an echo of that. Our Ancient Faith. This was how he described democracy. This is a phrase that gets pulled from the famous Peoria speech that he delivers on October 16, 1854, which I think is one of his great, almost greatest of his speeches. But it reflects on his outlook that democracy is, as he once put it, the most natural, the most healthful, the most conducive to human flourishing form of government that could possibly be. It's the thing which conforms most readily to the kind of natural law principles that Jefferson talked about in the Declaration of Independence.
Mm-hmm.
So for him, democracy is something that you embrace with your whole soul because it represents something as close to truth as you can get in politics. Probably in politics as close as you could get to something that would sound like religious truth. For him, then, to defend democracy is to defend this with his whole soul.
The idea and the word consent is mentioned early on in Our Ancient Faith. It's a key concept for Abraham Lincoln. How does the idea of consent inform his opinions on both democracy and slavery?
Consent, for him, is the bedrock, the foundation of democracy. Without the consent of the governed, for one thing, you don't get a Declaration of Independence because this is how Jefferson describes the foundations of government. And Jefferson himself is drawing off deep wells of political thought in the Enlightenment from Montesquieu, from Beccaria, from John Locke. For Lincoln, as much as for Jefferson, the true foundation of any real government has to emerge from the consent of the governed. This is what Locke described. This is how Beccaria described the creation of laws. This is how Montesquieu describes the spirit of the laws. That's, of course, the title of his most famous work. So Jefferson appropriates this. He talks about the consent of the governed. That's the basis. And Lincoln seizes on that to say, this, too, is what he calls, again, referring to the great Peoria speech of 1854, it's the sheet anchor of American republicanism, this experiment in democratic republicanism. It's the sheet anchor. It's what holds things in place. It's what keeps them from being destroyed in a storm. It's what keeps the ship of democratic state from being swept away by currents that it cannot control. So it is the foundation. It is what makes everything go in a democracy. Subtract consent from the equation, and you don't have democracy, which is something that he captures in a series of sentences that he jots down on a scrap of paper. It's a note that he's writing to himself, probably at the very beginning of the Lincoln-Douglas debates in 1858. And what he says there is this: as I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. This expresses my idea of democracy. Whatever differs from this, to the extent of the difference, is no democracy. Scott, that's as close as the man comes to giving us a kind of dictionary definition of democracy. And you can see how closely consent is wrapped up with that. Because a slave is someone who does not consent. No one even seeks the consent of a slave. A slave is someone who is merely the extension of the will of a master.
If consent is key for Lincoln, as you explain in Our Ancient Faith, Dr. Alan Belzo, he is suspicious of passions that, as you write, threaten to send democracy off its legal rails. How can one act to control those passions?
We use the word passion a lot today, Scott, and usually we use it in the context of people being asked, what's your passion? You sit down for a job interview, or you sit down for some other kind of discussion. People ask, what's your passion? What they really mean by that is, what are you really interested in? What gets you out of bed in the morning? All right, that's a fairly benign way of using the word passion. On the other hand, passion has some very negative connotations. We talk about crimes of passion, where people are carried away by emotion, by impulse, to do really reprehensible things that if they were thinking clearly or thinking in their right mind, they would never dream of doing. In that context, passion takes on a very evil coloring, and so it did for Lincoln. Lincoln addresses this issue about passion in one of his early speeches, actually one of the first major speeches that set him apart as an interesting political thinker and character. And that was his Lyceum speech of 1838, which he gave for the Springfield, Illinois, his hometown, the Young Men's Lyceum in that town. And in it, he's reflecting on what has happened for a year beforehand. The year before he gives this speech, the American landscape had been pockmarked with riot, with all manner of disruptions, with lynchings. And he says, this cannot be in a democracy. In a democracy, we don't function on the basis of passion. If we do, then what we're inviting is a response that will bring a dictator to power. Think of it this way, he says. If people act passionately, and some people take matters into their own hands, a lynching, for instance, the murder of an unpopular newspaper editor, what will happen to the people who stand around watching this? They will conclude that the government under which they're living is weak and misguided. And really, there needs to be someone who will come in, take over, and introduce some kind of order. That is the characteristic of a Caesar, of a Napoleon Bonaparte, of an Alexander the Great. And that really means that people are, in fact, incapable of governing themselves, that people are carried away by passion and by impulse and just can't be relied upon. This consent of the governed thing? Well, who would possibly dream of seeking the consent of the governed if the governed are in fact going to behave in these irrational patterns? So Lincoln sees in that really the destruction of democracy, because in order to preserve some kind of sense of a decent life for themselves, ordinary people will turn to the Caesar, the Alexander, the Bonaparte. What will keep a democracy from going down that path? After all, if democracy is about consent of the governed, doesn't that mean the governed can do anything they like? Lincoln says, no, it doesn't.
We'll pause there. More with Dr. Alan Gelzo in just a few minutes. His new book, Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Redding Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history.
We'd like to thank the Redding Rancheria for all their community support, including the bike shop. They do so much for our community, and we're beyond grateful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rancheria. You are the ones we can always count on to help us out in tough times. They're the people that have always been there for us, much more so than anyone else in our community. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts.
Redding Rancheria. Proud to play our part.
Now is a great time to prepare for the upcoming wildfire season. REU and city staff are busy clearing vegetation to mitigate wildfire risk to our power lines, facilities, and the community. You can also prepare by trimming back shrubs and tree branches that are closer than 5 feet from your home. Clear debris from your roof and gutter and clear dead vegetation on your property. For information about tree trimming and proximity to power lines, call 530-224-4356. Please remember, we all need to work together to prevent wildfires in our community.
Happy holidays from our Home Helpers family to yours. At Home Helpers, we are proud to help your loved ones celebrate this holiday season from the safety and comfort of their own homes. We are equally proud of the men and women who can't be with us. To the bravest among us, far from home serving our country this holiday season, to all members of the military in all branches, past and present, and those who made the ultimate sacrifice, with respect, gratitude, and love, we thank you. Happy holidays from all of us at Home Helpers. Life takes you to unexpected places. Love brings you home.
Hello, Northern California. This is Rollin with the Flag Center. With fire season clearly upon us, we're inviting you to join us in celebrating all police, firefighters, and first responders who keep us safe day and night through thick and thin. We salute you. The Flag Center keeps plenty of Thin Blue Line and Thin Red Line flags in stock. To get yours, stop by the Flag Center at 2124 Hilltop Drive or on the web at theflagcenter.com. Flags, flagpoles, and accessories since 1980.
Redding businesses, listen up. Black Bear Diner is now offering catering for events, meetings, and gatherings. Fuel your team with our delicious homestyle meals that everyone will love. Ready to make your next event a hit? Visit blackbeardiner.com for more information and place your order. Black Bear Diner, your go-to for great food and good times.
Black Bear Diner.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
Good morning, Redding. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Redding Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history.
Mimi Mosley here from Mosley Family Sellers. We'd just like to thank Redding Rancheria for their generous gift to us. It was so helpful and helped to keep us alive.
Hi, I'm Shelby Mahara with Squishy Doodle Face Painting, and I just wanted to say a huge thank you to Redding Rancheria for all of their support. They always help the community and always help to take care of us when they can.
Redding Rancheria, proud to play our part.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Our guest is Dr. Alan Gelzo. His new book, Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment. We talk in depth about that on today's program. Dr. Gelzo, as we look at Abraham Lincoln, how would you describe his personality? How does he comport himself in his approach to government?
Lincoln himself was a man who tried to be governed by reason. He was a man of rationality. I mean, he's born at the very end of what we call the Long Enlightenment. And for him, the guiding stars of his intellectual life were the same guiding stars that inspired Jefferson and the founders, the political thinkers, the great political thinkers of the Enlightenment. And these are political thinkers who laud the role of reason as a restraint on murder and passion. So how in a democracy do the governed keep from becoming their own worst enemy? The answer for Lincoln is law. First, because law itself is an expression of reason. It is how people work out the on the one hand, on the other. Should we do this? Should we do that? Law and the creation of law are about deliberation. They are about a sense of what is done on the one part has to be done on the other part. That's what governs the creation of law. Law is about reason. Law is what will restrain a democracy from going off those rails. So when Lincoln in the Lyceum Address is talking about how democracy can keep from surrendering to passion, the answer is law. And for him, reverence for the laws is so important that he's willing to call it a political religion. He is willing to say that reverence for the law should teach us to abide by the laws, even when we think the law might in fact be wrong, might in fact represent a mistake. Yes, there's always a chance to change a law further on down the road, but for the moment, you obey the laws, even when you disagree with them. And he speaks of the keeping of law as something that should be taught in schools, it should be taught in churches, it should even be taught by mothers with their infants in their laps. That will make for a society in which the consent of the governed, in fact, turns to the goal of promoting and underscoring human flourishing.
Dr. Alan Gelzo with us. His new book, Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment. Early on in Our Ancient Faith, you discuss the importance of these social mores to democracy. Later, more specifically, you mentioned those that are most important for Lincoln. What did he truly value?
Lincoln thought a great deal, much more so, I suspect, than we often give him credit for, about people's habits, about what shapes habits. And he saw the shaping of habits emerging from a variety of sources. First of all, was public opinion. He had a very high role to assign to public opinion. If you can influence public opinion, and the ways you do it, of course, are numerous. You do it through newspapers. You do it through speaking publicly. You do it through mass meetings. But if you can influence public opinion, you can certainly influence the overall outcome of the way people are going to imagine the operation of laws in a democracy should be. So that respect for, but also determination to impact and influence public opinion is for Lincoln extremely important. It's tied to his reverence for democracy. He understands that people have to be persuaded. Maybe that's not too much of a surprise, because after all, he was, by profession, a lawyer. He's in the business of persuading people, and he's actually quite good at it. You read his letters, you read his public statements, and you read the text of his speeches. Here is a man who is in the business of persuading people, and his quarter of a century career as a lawyer, especially out on the Eighth Judicial Circuit as a trial lawyer, underscores that. But influencing public opinion also has to have a certain set of assumptions. Some of those assumptions are tied to religion. Now, curiously, Lincoln is not a man with a very high formal religious profile. He never joins a church. He's the only president, in fact, who has never joined a church. He never partook of any of the symbols of most of the confessional Christian churches of his day. And people held this as a point of objection. He was very conscious that this damaged him politically. And yet, he is not the sort of person who's going to walk into a church and say, just for convenience sake, I'd like you to make me a member. I think there are probably lots of churches that would have been happy to do that.
Yes.
Just to have Abraham Lincoln on their roll.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Never seems to have occurred to him. He was a man who respected not only reason, but honesty sufficiently that he would not try to perpetrate a fraud, especially an intellectual fraud, on other people. And yet, at the same time, he also understands how important the religious underpinnings and assumptions of a culture are. And he will, on the one hand, talk increasingly as president about the role and importance of God in American life, and especially in his own decision-making. When he becomes president, some of the first things he says about religion are fairly conventional. But the more we move into the war years, the more serious it's plain. He's been thinking about these things. And he begins to make notes and statements that show that his mind is turning over this question, this problem. Why, if a war to abolish slavery is a good thing, if that represents something which is right over against something which is wrong, then why is it costing so much time, so much treasure, so much bloodshed to bring it to some kind of conclusion? And he works on that for all the years that he is president until it finally brings him to the second inaugural address. Second inaugural address is a very short inaugural address. And there's only one part of it where he really speaks to the war itself, and that's at the very beginning. About one quarter of the way through the second inaugural, he pivots.
Huh.
He pivots to ask what God's purpose in the war is. And he has a surprising answer for people. He says that both North and South stand guilty before God of imbruing their hands in this awful crime of slavery. And therefore, the war has come the way it has come because both North and South are undergoing a punishment for this.
Hmm.
And it's precisely because both North and South are undergoing punishment. He's not doing a victory lap in the second inaugural. It's because both North and South bear the guilt of this that the next step is malice toward none, and charity for all. You're watching a president of the United States being inaugurated, trying to explain not only what has happened, but where he intends to go in the future and what the basis of it is going to be. And it's a theological basis.
Dr. Alan Gelzo, we have just a little bit more to cover in this great new book, Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment. A bit more next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Turtle Bay's 5th annual Redding Garden of Lights is back for another fun-filled holiday season, open on select dates from November 22nd through January 5th. Featuring over 10 acres of outdoor illuminated gardens filled with 2 million lights, don't miss this year's new additions, including new light displays and premium ticket packages. Plus, holiday-themed food, drinks, music, glowing swings, model trains, and much more. Redding Garden of Lights is presented by Mercy Medical Center Redding. Buy tickets now at turtlebay.org.
Own owners, landlords, and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com.
Hi friends, RC here with this month's Cigar of the Humidor. Don Pepin Original Exclusivos Nicaraguan Puro Corojo Wrapper equals a Don Pepin Classic. Cubanesque in flavor, strength, and size, this is the stick to celebrate your latest victory. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
North Valley Distributing, a major supplier of electrical and electronic products for the industrial and construction markets, is proud to sponsor Operation Holiday Salute on KCNR to thank our veterans and those currently serving in the armed forces for your dedication and service to our country. North Valley Distributing at 3081 Crossroads Drive offers a full range of electrical and electronic products and services. All of us at North Valley Distributing wish you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
At Cornerstone Community Bank, you're more than just a customer. You're our friends, neighbors, the local businesses where we shop, and the restaurants where we dine. Your success strengthens our community. Come meet our amazing teams in Redding, Red Bluff, and our newest location in Anderson, and find out why we are more than banking. Cornerstone Community Bank, member FDIC and equal housing lender.
Bye. Join me for the first Thursday of every month at 6 p.m. for my show, North State Now. In this one-hour show, we cover what's happening in the music scene, theater, food, and arts. We get in-depth interviews with local business owners, musicians, actors, and authors. Listen in, tune in, call in, participate. Win tickets to concerts and theater productions. It's a lot of fun, and believe me, it keeps us going. Join me, your host, Linda Bott, for North State Now, the first Thursday, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Also streaming at KCNR1460.com.
Join Tokens Radio Show every Sunday at 2 p.m. on 96.5 FM and AM 1460 as hosts Christy Matthews and Linda Kent explore the exciting world of cryptocurrency and blockchain technology. Learn how Bitcoin is revolutionizing finance and grasp sound money principles. Hear new perspectives on achieving financial freedom beyond broken institutions. The future of money is here. Empower yourself with knowledge. Listen to Tokens Radio Show with Linda and Christy this Sunday at 2 p.m. on KCNR. Big and exciting changes are underway.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu. You'll find older episodes of this show as well as other great Hillsdale College audio. Our Ancient Faith is the new book from Dr. Alan Gelzo, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment. Let me ask about a critique of Lincoln. How would you respond? How would you explain to those who say, why did Lincoln manifest so little energy in demanding the immediate and unconditional ending of slavery?
Well, I think there are two ways of responding to that. One is that he didn't think an immediate, unconditional end to slavery was going to provide all the positive results that some people assumed it was going to provide. Lincoln believed, rightly or wrongly, that slavery had created such an antagonism, such a gulf between the black and white races, that the only healthful way to build towards a future was, as he once put it, for both races to live themselves out of their old relationship and into a new one. Lincoln was not what you might call an absolutist. He did not believe in absolute, immediate, total, complete solutions all at once at one shop. He would not, for instance, have been, well, a believer in the political equivalent of shock therapy. And yet at the same time, he does profoundly believe that slavery is wrong. How do you cure this? You don't cure it overnight. You don't simply wave a magic wand and say, things will now be entirely different. People are not like that. And Lincoln understood that. He understood that for both black and white. Meeting a group of black representatives at the White House in August of 1862, he said, very frankly, your race has very little reason to love our race. You have suffered the greatest wrong that any people could possibly suffer. So he understands there is a work of reconciliation which has to take place. And that work of reconciliation is going to take time. But time, of course, was what the war did not afford.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, he is going to move towards immediate abolition, which he does in September of 1862 with the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation. But he will always insist that his ideal solution to the problem of slavery was that it should be gradual, should be over a period of time. People get used to a new way of relating to each other.
Uh-huh.
That it should be compensated. And by compensated, he meant compensation to the owners, not to the slaves themselves. And people, again, scratch their heads over that and say, well, is that fair? Well, what he's thinking of is if we're going to move into an environment in which slavery no longer exists, then the people who had once been the masters are going to need to employ those who had once been slaves. How are you going to do that
uh-huh.
without some kind of capital, without some way of actually paying wages? So that's operating in his mind as well. And then finally, not only should it be gradual, not only should it be compensated, it should be what he called voluntary. Not voluntary in the sense that some people can choose to emancipate and others cannot and get away with it. What he meant is it should be something which is acted out in a public forum like the legislature. People should not be able to go back at an act of emancipation and say, well, this was forced on us.
Uh-huh.
And yet the curious thing is that having laid that out as what he regarded as his own preferred way of doing things, what he actually does in the way of emancipation is uncompensated, it is immediate rather than gradual, and it is anything but voluntary. And that's what the form of the Emancipation Proclamation is. So, yes, one can criticize Lincoln pretty freely for his preferred plan. And yet, as he saw the necessity of the hour in 1862, he was quite prepared to move in another direction. He would say back, in fact, in 1858, he did not believe in the social or political equality of the races. And yet by 1865, this is exactly what he's promoting.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, promoting in his very last speech that he gives on April 11th, 1865. In the crowd that night was John Wilkes Booth.
Mm-hmm.
And Booth fastened onto that as his reason for murdering Lincoln on April 14th. So when one looks at Abraham Lincoln, be prepared for someone who is complicated, someone who is complex, someone who is prepared to express a preference for moving in a certain way, and yet who is also prepared, if circumstances and necessity dictate, to move in a different direction. He is not an easily predictable person. He is not, I should add, Scott, he's not a perfect person. He doesn't always get it right. As I like to say to people, Abraham Lincoln did not walk on the Potomac.
If I may ask one more question of Dr. Alan Gelzo, author of the new book, Our Ancient Faith, you're very clear about Lincoln's fear that democracy might be as easily torn apart by triumph as disaster. And if I can spin that toward your last chapter that touches on one of the more important what-ifs in American history. What if Lincoln had lived? How do you think Reconstruction would have gone differently if Lincoln were not assassinated and Lincoln took that mindset into those next years?
This is always a dicey moment because there's probably no question I'm asked more often than, well, what would have happened if Lincoln had lived? Mm-hmm. We love to ask what-if questions about Abraham Lincoln. I think in a sort of backhanded way, that's a tribute to how much importance we still attach to Abraham Lincoln. And while this is my educated guess and worth nothing more than that, I would say this. Had Lincoln lived, I think Reconstruction would have been pointed in a very different direction. Certainly Lincoln would have put his shoulder to the wheel for votes for the freed slaves, and there were a variety of reasons for him advocating that. I think that pattern, in fact, is clear even before his death. I think also he probably would have favored some kind of redistribution of confiscated Confederate land. He very much hoped that there would not have to be show trials at the end of the Civil War. He really hoped the Confederate leadership would just go into exile. And when they did, then the lands they abandoned could be put into the hands of the freed slaves. He certainly moved to make government-owned public land available to not only veterans of the Union Army, but especially black veterans of the Union Army. So I think there's probably some element in how he would see the economy of the Confederate South rebuilt. I think he'd probably also favor a more extended military occupation of the Confederate South. Not because he wanted necessarily to inflict military pain on people, but because he wanted to ensure the emergence of a political generation that would be beyond the pre-war slaveholding oligarchy that ruled the South. He would want to give the South time to grow a new political generation that could think in a new and different way. And I think all those would be things that we would see Lincoln favoring moving into Reconstruction. And yet, I'm always giving an and yet, because this is that complex. Reconstruction is such a thorny problem that it is always possible that Reconstruction might have been beyond the skills even of an Abraham Lincoln. I mean, for one thing, he would, if he obeyed the two-term rule, which was unwritten at that point, he would only have been president until 1869. Between 1865 and 1869, that's not a whole lot of time to achieve a meaningful Reconstruction. So perhaps he would have run out of time. Perhaps the problems of Reconstruction would have been beyond even the capacities of a Lincoln. We just do not know, except for one thing, and that is it could not have turned out worse than it actually did under Andrew Johnson.
We do not know, but we can learn what we do. In Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment, the new book by Alan Gelzo. You can find it at Amazon.com and elsewhere, and more at his website, alangelzo.com. Dr. Gelzo, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're very welcome, Scott, and it was fun to do.
Up next, Dr. Dutton Carney from Hillsdale's English Department begins a series on literary modernism and James Joyce. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Happy holidays from our Home Helpers family to yours. At Home Helpers, we are proud to help your loved ones celebrate this holiday season from the safety and comfort of their own homes. We are equally proud of the men and women who can't be with us. To the bravest among us, far from home serving our country this holiday season, to all members of the military in all branches, past and present, and those who made the ultimate sacrifice, with respect, gratitude, and love, we thank you. Happy holidays from all of us at Home Helpers. Life takes you to unexpected places. Love brings you home.
Hello there, this is Kevin Cry. Every other Sunday, I will be on KCNR, your talk radio, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. I will be discussing the issues that matter to you most. You'll be able to call in directly, ask questions, and have a dialogue open and free every other Sunday right here on KCNR, your talk radio.
KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and KCNR1460.com has teamed up with Michelle Slade from My Umbrella Marketing, the Turtle Bay Exploration Park, and Black Bear Diner at 2605 Hilltop Drive to help out Toys for Tots this holiday season and give you a chance to win some great prizes, including 4 tickets to the Turtle Bay Garden of Lights and $50 in gift certificates, better known as Black Bear Bucks from Black Bear Diner. All you have to do to get into our drawing is donate a brand new unwrapped toy valued at $10 or more to the KCNR studios at 1326 Market Street in downtown Reading. Then your name goes into a drawing coming up December 12th at 8:15 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott during Free Fire Radio on KCNR. Teaming up with Michelle Slade from My Umbrella Marketing, the Turtle Bay Garden of Lights, and Black Bear Diner to help out Toys for Tots this Christmas. And giving you a chance to win some great prizes on KCNR. No purchase necessary to enter the drawing, one entry per person.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Check us out on X, formerly Twitter, at Hillsdale Radio, for show information and guest details. We're joined by Dr. Dutton Carney. He is Associate Professor of English here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Carney, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
We're beginning a brief series today about the writer James Joyce. And in this first conversation, we want to talk a bit about Joyce, the man, his contributions, and a little about literary modernism as well. So we start with the man, James Joyce. Tell us, please, a little about him and his background and an overview of what we should know about him and his life.
Sure. He is born at toward the end of the 19th century and dies toward the middle of the 20th century. And what he does is he ushers in pretty much all of literary modernism. He's born in 1882 and he dies in 1941. He's the oldest of 10 siblings, so he feels the burden of being the eldest child. He gets a Jesuit education. He goes to University College, and then after he graduates, he goes to Paris to study medicine. And during this time, he's writing all the time. He writes a collection of short stories, Dubliners, writes a play, Exiles, writes a novel, The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, after he had scrapped a previous version of that novel called Stephen Hero. He gets married and has a child. And then what's interesting is that he moves to France and then to Italy. And then Ezra Pound convinces him to move back to Paris, and he lives the rest of his life there. But he never stops writing about Dublin, never stops writing about Ireland. And what's really interesting is that his books, while kind of, they look like they all come out around the same time, and he is working on texts at the same time, but what happens is that he has a lot of his work censored, and so these books get put on the shelf,
mm-hmm.
And while Ulysses is published in 1922, we don't have an edition in America till 1934, and there are similar problems throughout Europe. And so his influence is vast among other writers, but he was very famous, but he didn't get rich.
You mentioned a few of his works, and we're going to talk about some specifically in future installments and future conversations, but if people know, or perhaps have read some James Joyce, what do they know from him?
Undoubtedly Ulysses. That is his major work. But maybe you've learned how to write a short story and you've read Dubliners. And then he writes a novel, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. And we start to see not necessarily realism being the purpose of the novel, but an opportunity to explore beauty and aesthetics. And so aesthetics becomes one of the major topics of concern and interest, the 20th century, and Joyce kind of gives us a way into that. He starts off with a book of poetry called Chamber Music. He says snidely that really the chamber music is the music of the chamber pot, and so he doesn't see that the poetry is the best of poetry, but he does have Yeats read some of it,
mm-hmm.
and that's really interesting. And then he writes a play modeled after Henrik Ibsen called Exiles, and what Joyce does is that he writes a lengthy review of an Ibsen play in an Irish magazine that review gets communicated over to Ibsen, and then Ibsen, through Ibsen's publisher or Joyce's publisher, thanks him for that. And so Joyce teaches himself Norwegian to write a letter to Henrik Ibsen. So he's got this amazing capacity for learning.
Talking with Dr. Dudden Carney about James Joyce and literary modernism, and in many ways, Joyce is the leading figure in literary modernism. Where does this come from? What are the influences that give rise to this movement?
I think the major influence is World War One. World War One absolutely devastated all of Europe. And so we had this, maybe not a centralized Europe, but at least we had something that was semi-unified. Now it's all annihilated. And so everyone starts to see things in terms of fragmentation. World War One had an amazing influence on T.S. Eliot. He's working for Lloyd's of London in London, and he's the one who has to write the checks to pay for loss of life, loss of property, and the numbers are just astronomical and absolutely unheard of. There's a movement toward urban life, and people are living in the cities, and the 9-to-5 workday is not that exciting. And so after kind of this urban setting being annihilated, people are thinking about, well, what is the center? What holds our lives together? What is, as Joyce will come back to this, and he sees this in Homer in the Odyssey, what's the omphalos? What's the navel of the world through which the world is renewed and nourished? And so someone like Ezra Pound, he says, well, let's look to the literary tradition. And he writes this work called the Cantos. And the first canto is a Robert Browning poem. And he realizes, no, that's too soon. And so he goes all the way back to book 10 of the Odyssey. And the first lines of the Cantos is a translation of the Odyssey. And so what Pound wants to do is to let's create an omphalos that is rooted in classical myth. Someone like William Yeats, he looks mm-hmm. to Irish fairyland, and then he looks to Irish history, and then he creates a space called Byzantium, and Byzantium is a place of poetic beauty. And in each one of those cases, he's trying to find something that's going to hold it all together. And then we have T.S. Eliot, who looks at Western civilization and Christianity and uses those as a centering, as something that can center civilization, but a world that doesn't want to hear about Western civilization and Christianity, so he has to kind of mask it through fragments. And then Joyce, what he does is that he isn't going to create a new mythology, but he's going to utilize Dublin. And what he wants to do is to out-realist the previous realist of, say, Balzac and Zola. So he's not trying to create a central mythos so much as he's trying to show that everybody at their fundamental level, that in just kind of a realist approach to life, is living out an epic existence.
How would you best summarize those defining features that we see in works of literary modernism?
Well, first off, there's an unreliable narrator. Mm-hmm. You never know if the person is perceiving what's being described. And then on top of that, there are several narrators. So you have many narrators, and so it opens up this polyphonic dimension of the novel, where you have several voices all describing the same scenario, but with a slightly different reading of what they're identifying. The setting often doesn't exist in the real world. So I mentioned Yeats's Byzantium, but there's Macondo by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, or Yaknapatawpha County from Faulkner, that they'll create a place that serves as an alternative world where the real world can be placed into it. What Joyce said is that, no, we can just do that with Dublin. And so he focuses on the realistic aspect, but he's doing a lot of the same things. Well, I guess we should say that Marquez and Yeats and Faulkner are doing a lot of the same things that Joyce is doing.
Talking with Dr. Dutton Carney about literary modernism and James Joyce, what are some of the defining features of literary modernism?
A list of what the qualities of literary modernism are. You just have to go through Ulysses and start marking down bullet points. Mythic allusions are deeply embedded in the text, and you may not catch it, and that's okay. The central images of modernism would be the city and then the machine. We see those over and over again. And there is a lot of fragmentation in modernity, but we should keep in mind that there is an entirety that exists. There's a wholeness that does exist that the authors are structuring their work around. We're kind of in, well, maybe we're moving out of the postmodern period. I think that people are getting tired of not having any meaning anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But in postmodernism, there's no center. There's no holistic meaning. Basically, it's just whatever you want it to be. The moderns always think that the world has meaning, that words mean things, that we can rely on symbols and images to communicate to one another.
And we'll talk deeper and more in depth about a number of James Joyce's works here in the coming weeks on the program. Dr. Dutton Carney, Associate Professor of English here at Hillsdale College, as we talk today about James Joyce the Man and literary modernism. Dr. Carney, thanks so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you so much, Scott.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Alan Gelzo, his new book, Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment, and Dr. Dutton Carney from Hillsdale's English Department. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. The assistant producer of the program is Sam Lair. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Turtle Bay's 5th annual Reading Garden of Lights is back for another fun-filled holiday season. Open on select dates from November 22nd through January 5th. Featuring over 10 acres of outdoor illuminated gardens filled with 2 million lights. Don't miss this year's new additions, including new light displays and premium ticket packages. Plus, holiday-themed food, drinks, music, glowing swings, model trains, and much more. Reading Garden of Lights is presented by Mercy Medical Center Reading. Buy tickets now at turtlebay.org.
Hello, I'm Patrick Jones from Jones's Fort Gun Shop, serving Shasta County for over 50 years. As Christmas and New Year's approaches, we at Jones's Fort would like to thank all of the men and women in the United States Armed Forces. Loyalty, duty, respect, honor, and integrity are just a few things that the U.S. military stands for. Jones's Fort salutes you.
Looking for a unique gift this Christmas? Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage, and Collectibles in the Shasta Gateway Center on Highway 273 in Anderson has distinct treasures to choose from, including Christmas decorations, vinyl records, DVDs, vintage toys, and antique jewelry, such as brooches and rings, necklaces, and bracelets. Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage, and Collectibles also offers vintage clothing and accessories, such as retro dresses and scarves, jackets and hats, along with vintage furniture, tablecloths, and silverware, cookware, and glassware. And don't forget Mantiques, including military memorabilia, camping and mining equipment, men's jewelry such as crosses and rings, sports memorabilia, and collectibles. Come find that perfect gift this Christmas at Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage, and Collectibles in the Shasta Gateway Center on Highway 273 in Anderson. Open Monday 10 to 6, close Tuesday and Wednesday. Open Thursday through Saturday from 10 to 6, and Sunday noon to 5.
The Ramsey Show.
You actually can help people, and you don't help them by giving them a government program. You help them by showing them the way out. People love me enough to put their arm around me and show me a different way. I didn't figure it all out in my own head. So there's a power to hope. That's not some kind of false panacea positive thinking way. It works. You can't positive think your way into everything, but you can't negative think your way into anything.
Listen weekdays at noon on KCNR, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio station.
Ready, set, jingle. Get into the holiday spirit with the Jingle Bell Fun Run at Turtle Bay on Saturday, December 7th, starting at 4 p.m. This festive 2-mile walk or run will have you jingling all the way, with free entry into the Redding Garden of Lights at the end of the course. Register now at turtlebay.org/run for a night of holiday magic you won't want to miss.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Redding by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.